Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Ray Coleman, attorney at law, the attorney for Bill Tyree, and a law partner of William Pepper, James Earl Ray's attorney and the author of the book Orders to Kill, and also Mike Rupert, former LAPD narcotics detective and the editor of the From the Wilderness newsletter. Gentlemen, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, before we continue with a discussion of the lawsuit of Bill Tyree, let me state once again pro forma that neither myself nor the stations that carry this program has any information incriminating any of the individuals involved in this investigation in any criminal activities, and as far as I know, none of them has been convicted of any crime. And I will also refer to the various points of information as allegations. This is in no way to cast aspersions on any of the individuals or yourselves or the suit itself. This is simply pro forma. Okay?
Sure. Sounds good to me.
Okay. Now, we've been talking about an operation called Operation Watchtower, an operation called Operation Orwell, the former an alleged operation by elements of U.S. intelligence to bring drugs into Panama for transshipment into the United States, the latter an alleged surveillance operation of various elements that could be seen as possibly interdicting or frustrating this traffic. We've been talking about Bill Tyree, a former Special Forces trooper who was allegedly involved in Operation Watchtower, and then when he tired of those activities, his wife, Elaine, also in the Army, was murdered. She'd been acting as an informant for the Army's Criminal Investigations Division, and Bill Tyree was then framed for that murder. The lawsuit names as defendants George Bush, the Central Intelligence Agency, Oliver North, President Clinton, Mr. Harshbarger, his first name again?
Scott. I think it's Luther Scott. Luther. Everybody knows him as L. Scott.
L. Scott Harshbarger and Paul Cellucci, the one a candidate for governor of Massachusetts, the other the acting governor of Massachusetts, and also a very interesting fellow named Chip Tatum, whom we'll get to in a minute. With that introduction, we were talking about some of the operations of Edwin Wilson, Frank Turpel, and those were named, that investigation, or those investigations, came up with a group of names who later became, to a certain extent, household words, or at least in those households that were following Iran-Contra. The raison d'etre for Operation Watchtower was what, Mike Rupert?
Well, it was basically the same as it always has been with CIA, which was to provide money, unaccountable, untraceable money for the perpetuation, continuation of covert operations outside of congressional oversight. This is a stumbling block which is really artificial that some people run into. You say that the Watchtower missions occurred in 75, 76, and 77. Well, my goodness, what happened after and what happened before? This is not a parenthesis in eternity here is what I'm saying, or maybe it is, in that you have to look at the much longer continuum of CIA involvement in drug trafficking historically, going way back to the 40s, but certainly continuing from Southeast Asia, where many of these hands cut their teeth, so to speak, and even earlier in Ted Shackley's case and Ed Wilson. But they continued afterwards as well. If you look at the Watchtower missions, which were described in the Cotullo affidavit as ending in 77, I believe, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden CIA stopped flying cocaine, and all of a sudden they started again when the Contra War effort began. What happens with a great many of these operations is that they mutate, given changing circumstances, whereas you might have a political situation which would necessitate flying directly from Colombia to Panama to stage the cocaine to be held for transshipment into the States. With a resultant coup in Honduras, let's say, the scope and nature of the missions may change where you don't need them, and you know, a political change in Colombia could provide the means to fly above radar with U.S. air traffic controllers and AWACS in control, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I think that this also provides a way to understand what happened in MENA, Arkansas, and how MENA would connect, and that we know that there was a horrendous amount of cocaine moving through MENA, but through the history of the people involved, the personnel involved, there is a continuum established which goes back, and it's a thread woven through the Watchtower missions going back before and continuing long after.
Mike, if you could, or Mike and or Ray, if you could briefly review the allegations concerning Mina for us. We've covered them on these airwaves before, but might be useful under the circumstances.
Well, who's going to take that? Ray, you want it?
Okay. The allegations are that after Panama nominally closed down, the flights were diverted over the Caribbean and into fairly remote areas, only like 6,000-7,000 people, in Amina, Arkansas. At the same time as drugs were being flown in for distribution, guns were being flown out for use in third world countries, Contras, and depending upon who happened to need them at the time. So it was a sort of like a truck terminal, and various and sundry people of note. And right now we're trying to track down how many of the defendants were there, other than the obvious Bill Clinton.
I think it's important to note, if I can jump in real briefly,
sure,
that United States covert military support in Central America did not begin with the Contras. There's a long historical, well-documented record, especially in El Salvador and Guatemala, that CIA was arming death squads, those linked to Daubuisson and a number of other people, in those regions before the Contra effort ever got really off the ground. So this was a mechanism which was established. I would say the paradigm was really perfected in Laos with Ted Shackley to arm, like the Montagnards, and arm other groups to go fight, pay for it with drugs, and run the operation under CIA control and have a lot of atrocities result. That model was in use before the Contra effort started roughly in 1981.
Now, there also is another point I think we might want to touch on, which is that even before the CIA assumed complete stewardship of the Contras, some of their allies from Argentina, themselves closely allied with the Coca Fascisti in Bolivia, had been sort of shepherding the Contras prior to the most overt CIA involvement.
That's very, very true, and of course, if you scratch very softly beneath that facade, you come to a whole host of ex-Nazis.
Right. You mentioned in connection with some of the death squad activity and some of the terrorist activity in other parts of Latin America, El Salvadorian elements such as Daubuisson. In an earlier discussion, Mike, you mentioned that the assassination of Archbishop Romero was going to figure in this lawsuit. Can you detail that if you're in a position to do so, Ray?
Well, the lawsuit, although specifically uses Watchtower as a view, we also allege that the United States has used its military forces either directly or as trainers, instructors, in various and sundry other illegal activities, particularly in South America and in Central America. One of those is the formation of security forces through the School of the Americas in Benny. No, Bragg, I guess it is. That part of that is the result of the assassination of the Archbishop and also of the Jesuits, the six Jesuit priests, and various and sundry activities as far as the religious social activist people were concerned.
One of the people who was mentioned in the case as a defendant is Chip Tatum. I found that rather surprising in light of some of your earlier writings about Chip Tatum, Mike Rupert.
Well, I think Ray will confirm this, is that, you know, everybody wants to know what Chip Tatum has to say about this case, and it is my belief, and Ray can flesh this out as he wishes to, that Chip would like to tell us what he knows about this case.
Yes, we always like to have somebody who has a different view of the same event or events. And Mr. Tatum has come forward, a very disgruntled individual as far as how he was treated when his time working for the government was over.
And he worked in what capacity, Ray?
He was a pilot running, flying drugs across the Caribbean into the United States.
So he was actually one of the freight carriers, so to speak, in these operations, according to the allegations presented in the suit.
Right. Right, he would be, he'd pick it up and drop it off, as you say, a freight carrier.
Okay.
Now, we have him in as what is theoretically, we nickname him as a friendly defendant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that we want him to cough up money and so on and so on and so forth, but he certainly is a part of the continuation of the illegal operations, and it would give us more insight into the various sundry other aspects that we're going to have to form, as well as he may very well be able to put some of the other defendants together more closely than we already have.
Mike, there was a comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, I think it's real interesting to note that in the April issue of my newsletter, I described the last conversation I had with Chip, in which he had indicated that his deal of the moment, deal du jour for him, because he stands on quicksand a lot, was that Oliver North would take a public fall behind the drug trafficking issue. A lot of people scoffed at that, but I think with the recent revelations in Volume 2 of the CIA's Inspector General's report, which basically in which the CIA lays out Oliver North like a piece of trash, they point their finger at him on several occasions, especially in the case of Moises Nunez, a major trafficker, who said that he couldn't talk about his drug trafficking activities because of instructions and orders concerning his work with the National Security Council. Well, that was Oliver North, and the companies with which Nunez were connected had bank accounts, which the CIA acknowledges were established by Oliver North. So North is extremely vulnerable on this at the moment, and I, for one, would love to see Ray get this into the courtroom and to pursue that avenue a little bit.
Ray, do you want to comment on that?
We're actually looking forward to getting him in the courtroom.
Okay. There are a couple of interrelated questions that I'd like to toss out to both of you. And this, again, I want to stress, is in no way to dump on either of you or anybody involved in the lawsuit. In a previous discussion, Mike, we have mentioned how much this lawsuit would appear to be similar to the ill-fated Christic Institute lawsuit in the 1980s and early 90s. There certainly is a vast scope from an historical standpoint that is incorporated in this suit. We're going all the way back to the 1970s, right on up through Bill Clinton's terms as president, and there certainly are a lot of very powerful individuals involved here. One of the questions I have, as someone who is not legally well-versed, is how a cohesive lawsuit could tie so many of these elements together in a legally viable way, to coin a term. I wonder if the two of you would discuss that and also address the issue of whether or not this suit could be vulnerable in the same way that the Christic Institute suit was.
Well, one of the things, and I'm not really familiar with the Christic lawsuit, one of the things that is unique as far as Billy's situation is concerned is that Carone is, you had mentioned, like gluing everything together.
Right.
I refer to it as the pivot point. Everything really revolves around Carone. He was, and I don't know if people understood Mike when he said he was a paymaster. If you needed something, you called Carone, he got it. And to the point where he was there to see if you needed anything, and it was there for you. So that he was the one who threw all kinds of stuff, kept track for the government. And he also played that part with crime families. He, in his last days, gave Billy a tremendous amount of information, which we are putting in place now and putting it in its proper perspective and acting on it. That is the point that made this case. Up until the point where we could tie Carone in, Billy had at best a Hail Mary kind of lawsuit. But once we found out that Carone actually received the Elaine's diaries, that's what really gelled everything together.
And
Carone has put all of the defendants together, if not expressly, then he's given us enough information so that we can follow up and put them together.
And that has been confirmed, Carone's receipt of the diaries and transfer of those to CIA?
Yes, in a rather interesting way. His daughter saw the diaries and heard about the diaries. His son-in-law was at the apartment and saw some notebooks on the table and happened to flip them open and saw two pictures, one of a soldier, a young soldier, 19 years or so, and the other picture of a very lovely young woman, late teens, early 20s. And the colonel became very upset when he saw this and slammed him shut and said, "You know better than that. You know better than that." 20 years later, when Mr. Ferdinand was shown a picture of a young Bill Tyree and his now deceased wife, that's the guy. That's the guy. That's the picture I saw on the notebooks. And that was when this lawsuit really took a deep breath and started running.
Now, Mike, you mentioned in an earlier discussion about Albert Benson Carone that he died of chemical toxicity of unknown etiology in 1990.
Yes. He had returned from a mission to Mexico in 1985, and was extremely upset. He was disenchanted, to say the least, had, in effect, lost his stomach for all of the covert work he had done, and he lamented to his daughter and son-in-law that, as a result of this particular CIA mission, which fell under the umbrella name of Amadeus, which is a direct link to George Bush, by the way, that a DEA agent had been murdered. Kidnapped and murdered, and that was in Mexico. And he was, of course, referring to Kiki Camarena, who was the only DEA agent to have ever been murdered, let alone in Mexico. It was a short time thereafter that he was aware that he was going to be killed, and he began to suffer a series of ailments, which I guess started in roughly 86, 87, which led to liver, kidney, brain failure. His brain atrophied, everything just kind of disintegrated, and a number of doctors, and I cover this in my investigation of Al Carone, examined him, could not put their fingers on a cause of death, and the cause of death on the certificate was listed as chemical toxicity of unknown etiology, which I have lovingly come to call as the CIA flu. There's another important point about the lawsuit. Ray is not perhaps as familiar with the Christic case as I am. Christic was a RICO civil lawsuit based on a bombing in Nicaragua, which occurred outside of the United States. So what also is really unique about Bill Tyree's suit, and very distinguishing from the Christic Institute suit, is that we have a 1975 civil decision, a 75 appellate affirmation of that decision, judgments against the police officers in air for the illegal removal of the property, and a whole series of orders to return the property, which have not been complied with, which is an absolute damn good legal foundation for a lawsuit. So this can't be dismissed on any kind of ground saying that there's no basis for it. And I think Ray is absolutely right, is that what sews it up is the Carone connection, which we weren't able to put together until within this last year.
reviewing very briefly for us, he is still listed as active duty military, even though he died in 1990.
Well, as long as he's active duty, they can't release any records. They're barred from that by the Privacy Act. But also, the investigative report which I wrote in 1994 after meeting Dee and her husband and spending several days with them and reviewing the records is now his official military record in St. Louis as far as the family is concerned. The rest of his records remain concealed.
You mentioned, too, that Theodore Shackley, one of the names that winds through this entire historical period in many of these allegations, was able to get his headstone changed from Staff Sergeant to Colonel.
Yeah, when I met Dee, when Big Al died, that's what everybody called him, was Big Al. When Big Al died, every trace of this man disappeared from the face of the earth. Now, we're not just talking military records, his NYPD pension. We are talking his New Mexico driver's license and four or five active bank accounts, which were actively being used by Caron and his daughter Dee to run the household. I mean, these were the checking accounts like you and I use every day. They were just absolutely erased, life insurance policies. It created enormous problems for the family. They were just suffering terribly and have been nonstop since. Dee was getting no satisfaction from anywhere in government, anywhere. And after really satisfying myself that this was, in effect, probably the mother lode for me in my lifetime as far as links to CIA wrongdoing, I looked at Dee and I said, as far as I am concerned, there is only one man in the world who can help you with this, and that's Ted Shackley. I don't know how you're going to find him. And I gave her a rundown as to Shackley's background and so on and so forth, and Dee, on her own, and she's pretty plucky, hunted down Robert Mayhew, a former aide to Howard Hughes with CIA connections, who gave her a phone number for Shackley. She made contact with Shackley, who acknowledged knowing Al Caron. They have had a number of phone conversations over the years. But within, I guess it was 10 days of Dee's first contact with Shackley, Al Caron's headstone, he had been buried as a staff sergeant, his highest rank in World War II, after which point the Army said he didn't exist anymore. Within 10 days, the headstone had been changed to full colonel. And Dee was able to acquire a copy of the order so directing, and subsequent to that, I believe Shackley confirmed to her that it was he who had ordered the change, but he hasn't, on many occasions, acknowledged to having known Al Caron very well.
All righty. We've got just over 5 minutes left in the interview. Let's come back to Caron in just a second. Mike Rupert, you wrote in a From the Wilderness issue that among the things that was going to be touched on in this lawsuit was the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and that the plans for martial law that agency made did surface during the course of the Christic Institute lawsuit that I alluded to earlier. Ray, you mentioned in the first part of our interview that Oliver North was apparently involved with activities in Latin America in the 1970s. Could you touch on what North was allegedly doing in the 70s, and also how is this suit going to impact on the whole FEMA situation?
Well, as far as the FEMA situation is concerned, we have alleged that the creation of FEMA is unconstitutional. It for several reasons. Number one, it does not define an emergency. Number two, it takes all power from the executive, all power from the legislative and the judiciary branches, and places it under an executive agency without any provision to return the respective powers to the respective branches. That was one of the things that was formed under an executive order, 123333, and we allege that executive order is totally void, unconstitutional, et cetera, et cetera. As far as North's activities in South America, prior to the Contras and so on and so forth, we're still trying to flesh that out. He's one of these people where he admits he was in Okinawa, and he admits he was here, and he admits he was there, and so on and so forth. But it's very sketchy. It is not a, should we say, a year-by-year breakdown. We know that he was with the he was a White House fellow, but we don't know what he did and what his duties were, and where he did it. I mean, as a White House fellow, you know, you pretty much, if you've got a job to do, you can go where you need to go in order to get that job done. So we're still working on those.
Okay, a couple of more points that I'd like to touch on. Mike, if you could, just very briefly, what do you think OPA, the Volume 2, is going to do for this suit?
I think Volume 2 is... Volume 2 is a virtual CIA confession to, in my opinion, complicity involvement in a conspiracy to change government policies on the reporting procedures for assets involved in drug trafficking, direct knowledge, protection of traffickers, so on and so forth. Volume 2 certainly makes, and in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, but the easiest leg of this case to make is that CIA deals drugs. Volume 2 just puts the cap on that. You know, that's it's utterly damning for Oliver North. There is no question about that, and it raises much deeper, darker questions, and it opens the doors to ask questions about CIA proprietaries, which leads to the role of people like Al Caron. Which, if scratched and pulled and pursued logically and certainly ethically, it will lead us back to people like Al Caron. I think Volume 2 does nothing but help.
Okay, speaking of Al Caron, Ray Coleman, in our last couple of minutes here, one of the affidavits have been filed in connection with the suit, alleging that Caron had made a payoff to Jack Ruby on 11-21-63, and that he also was present at Love Field on 11-22-63 with a rifle. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yes, he in his last days, and often this happens. He felt that he had an awful lot to make up for, and he wanted to do right, to make things right. He realized what he had done wrong. One of those was that he had several levels of participation in the Dallas assassination. One of those was to transfer money to a woman by the name of Ruth Hyde Payne. The other one was to transfer money to Jack Ruby. And one of the more interesting ones, I think, was that he stated he was on a rooftop with a high-powered weapon at Love Field when President Kennedy disembarked from his aircraft. But because there were obstacles, other people in the way, he really didn't have a clear line to the president. And therefore, once the president got totally out of his sight, he just packed up his weapon, descended the building, and then went back to report what had happened.
Okay, and we should use the term allegedly made payments to Ruth Payne,
yeah,
who was one of the Oswald's handlers in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Ted Kennedy has weighed in on behalf of Bill Tyree in a certain sense, hasn't he?
Very, very superficially. He's made some inquiries, or he stated he has made some inquiries, and we really don't know how serious Senator Kerry has made inquiries. He has his own problems, and...
No, I said Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy.
Right, right. Senator Kennedy.
Right.
Right. So we really don't know how much he is behind. The account in 79 and in 80 had a tremendous newspaper following, with a bugging of the courthouse, with Mrs. Tyree trying to get the alleged murderer back in the court, all kinds of stuff. And, of course, the Green Berets were highly motivated, highly respected. Here's one who murders his wife, and so on and so forth. And the Kennedys have pretty much stayed away from that. They write lovely letters, and I really don't know what their total involvement is. And to a certain extent, I can understand where they don't want to get involved. There's an awful lot of hurt and pain associated with that.
Understood. Well, we will see where this lawsuit goes. However, we're going to have to carry the story forward in a future interview because we're all out of time. We've been speaking with Ray Coleman, a law partner of William Pepper, author of Orders to Kill, and the attorney for the late James Earl Ray, and representing Bill Tyree in this vitally important lawsuit, and Mike Rupert, former LAPD narcotics detective, who has crusaded tirelessly to expose the role of the intelligence community in the drug traffic, and also the editor of From the Wilderness Newsletter. For Mike Rupert and Ray Coleman, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.